Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. Today, I'll be speaking with Richard Backstrom and Todd Myers, authors of Realizing the Witch, Science, Cinema, and the Mastery of the Invisible, published in 2015 by Fordham University Press. In the book, the two anthropologists review the historical concepts of witchcraft using the silent film Hexen, written and directed by Benjamin Christensen. Welcome to Richard Backstrom and Todd Myers.
Hi, Richard. It's great to talk to you.
Excellent to be here. Thank you.
And also you, Todd.
Thanks for having us.
Well, one of the great things about current academic publishing is that we have books like yours devoted to a fascinating but largely unknown film and its production. Let's talk first about your backgrounds and writings. Richard, where have you been over your career that has basically led you up to this point?
Well, I started my more, I guess, traditional ethnographic focus in Malaysia, and I was writing about urban life and the transformation of cities and city life in Southeast Asia, particularly in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And that doesn't really seem like it has much to do with leading to writing about a 1920s Scandinavian witchcraft film, but I think because we had a very sort of interdisciplinary and broad kind of focus in our training. Todd and I actually, we saw this film first together when we were graduate students. We were both, anthropologists and scholars in training. And so the pursuit of something related to creative art wasn't necessarily something that was beyond what we were interested in, even though in my case, my focus on the surface was a bit different. But I've always, also engaged more directly in creative arts and film in particular, and actually still do so even now. So it's a somewhat winding path, I would say. But it makes sense to me. I don't know if it makes sense to others, but I'm, that's kind of where I'm coming from, I guess.
Well, multidisciplinary is a good term that's being used pretty regularly these days in the educational community, and I think it's actually made for better scholarly work among everyone because it is such an important aspect. Where are you now currently? You're teaching now or?
Yes, I teach at the University of Edinburgh. So I live in Scotland and, sort of pursuing all sorts of programs, including a lot with the art school here, which is part of the University of Edinburgh now. And so this is also becoming a part of what I do in terms of what I teach and trying to get some programs together to kind of actualize and extend some of this interdisciplinary work that the book represents that Todd and I have done it together and, kind of take that in some other directions as well. So that's what I'm doing at the moment, I guess.
Okay. So Todd, obviously Richard mentioned you've known each other quite a while, and I know you're not in Scotland. You are in Asia. So what is your background? And like I said before, I know obviously he mentioned briefly that you've known each other quite a while. So where are you standing as far as your education and what you're doing now?
Well, just to kind of followed the same thread that Richard was sort of drawing out, which was, you know, my background is really focused on medical anthropology. So my interest is in kind of contemporary ethnography as it, you know, is used to sort of better understand health and illness. I do a lot of work in the States still. I'm also very interested in the history of medicine. And in fact, actually, I mean, when I think about this book and try to kind of work backwards into what the influence is and kind of what the continuities between parts of my training and leading up to this book are, I always think about, you know, Christensen's interest in late 19th century photography and writings in psychiatry. And that seems like a very clean line, but in fact, actually, I mean, my original training's in art. So I studied as a painter as an undergraduate, was always interested in film. Richard and I went to graduate school together. This is one of 1,000 films we watched together. It's probably one of 1,000 films that we could probably sit down and write a similar text. So of course, there's some kind of particularities to this text or to this film that, you know, demands a certain treatment in the writing. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about that as well. But Richard and I also did, you know, we made haunted houses when we were in graduate school. And so part of the genealogy of this book is a very focused and very dedicated commitment to our yearly graduate student haunted houses in the basement of my Baltimore row house. And I think, in fact, actually, it was our work in the haunted house that led us to Christensen and maybe appreciated some of his set designs and costuming even more as amateur haunted house proprietors.
Well, we used to act in the haunted houses as well. So, you know, we would become characters and try to take up the position of, you know, somebody possessed, somebody who's committed murder, somebody who might commit murder. You know, they were haunted houses for adults. And so it was a fairly full on commitment, I would say, to the supernatural and the strange. That
And like Christensen, we starred in our own productions. I mean, we didn't play Satan or Christ, but still, I mean, you know, we starred in our own productions. And I think in part this was the school play element of our inspiration.
It's funny, as Todd and I were talking before the interview, I'm actually from Cleveland, Ohio. I live in Kentucky now by way of Alabama. But when we were growing up, we did haunted houses for Halloween. We used to decorate the house for Halloween and actually made the newspaper once about what we do every year. And it's very sounds very similar, except it was just one day and it was the house itself and we built a coffin, the whole thing. I mean, that was just – so I guess that means there's a certain similarity among the three of us as far as that kind of thing is concerned.
And Christensen did the same thing, except he just made the most expensive film in Scandinavia at the time to do it. So – you know, and took him X number of years, 3+.
Yes, I mean, we certainly could have used his budget, but I think, definitely what this allowed us to do, I mean, this does link us back methodologically in a certain sense to what we try to do in anthropology, which is not necessarily, in Malinowski's words, unproblematically take up the position of the quote-unquote the native or the other, but we did try to, you know, understand this from an affective point of view as well. It's and ethnography does, as a kind of matter of course, demand this kind of engagement. And we felt that we could actually take this in a very different direction and talk about a film and talk about, you know, different forms of visual culture and scholarly sources in a way that that requires us to be caught by them and to embrace them and to express them in a way that might be somewhat different from other kinds of approaches to this specific kind of material. So actually it made perfect sense for us to act it out and then to express it in the way that we do, you know.
I mean, we're very specific in the beginning of the book. I mean, we talk about, you know, our treatment of Christensen's film as, you know, we treat the film anthropologically and also cinematically. And that anthropological part isn't just from our, you know, respective disciplines or backgrounds. It really is this, as Richard already said, this kind of animation, you know, this affective register by which Christensen, you know, constructed his film, acted it out, you know, circulated it after its production. We were really interested in all of those forms that took shape. And so we were not just treating it as a cinematic object. We're really trying to treat it through this anthropological lens. And I think that was, I mean, that wasn't by design as much as, you know, just part of the spirit of, I think, our shared sensibilities about how we like to engage with film anyways. And also, you know, the kind of relationship to our own respective kind of intellectual and fieldwork projects. So, I mean, that really, I mean, how we treat Christensen's film, I feel like it's how we've been treating film for a long time. Although there's just some, there's something about Christensen's project that, you know, just really drew us in immediately.
Well, I think any film that, especially at this period of time, I mean, that's one of the things that is so unusual about Hexen, is that it was made so early in the history of motion pictures, and we, and the concept of a film that had a longer length and actually tried to present a point other than just, you know, the old show the picture of the somebody, you know, film of somebody riding a horse, which wasn't too far before this. That's what makes it unusual in many ways, since it's so early in the history of motion pictures. How do, let's see if we can briefly set that. I mean, the film was released, the part I saw was 1922, but he'd been working on it for quite a long period of time. So what was unusual, groundbreaking, as far as the filmmaking aspects before we start talking about the content?
Richard, what was unusual here?
Okay, well, I'll give it a shot. You fill in what I okay. Get. But I mean, yes, I think, Joel, you've identified some of the aspects of what is unusual about it in its, you know, sort of feature length treatment of a nonfiction subject. And yet the sort of, you know, the bringing of scientific and historical sources, the sort of elaborate reenacting and the use of certain kinds of techniques that we, by the end of the 1920s, become a bit more normal to see in films, or, you know, the way in which close-ups are used, the way in which, you know, the film is edited and moves along. All of this, I think, is really quite ahead of its time. So it's quite ahead of its time in terms of its claim that you can do nonfiction in this way. And there's no such thing as documentary as yet. Documentary doesn't, as a term or as a genre, doesn't really come into being until 1926 or later, when John Grierson uses that term. But nevertheless, Christensen is very committed to rendering truth on film. And he, at the same time, is not shy about using all of the instruments at hand in the creation of the image. I mean, the sound is kind of ambiguous in silent film for obvious reasons, but in terms of the creation of the image and a narrative that can be drawn out of that image or a series of images, there's really, you know, there's really nothing exactly like it. Now, 1922 is also the year that a film like Nanook of the North comes out, which actually is innovative in some similar ways. But I would say that Christensen's project is in some ways, you know, even more ambitious in its aspiration to actually innovate not only the sort of our understanding, a popular understanding of witchcraft and of hysteria, but also just our ways of receiving film. And, you know, this was one of the things that we couldn't believe when we really started to get into learning more about this film, was that this film is largely ignored in the popular sort of narrative of how cinema develops and comes into being, not just nonfiction cinema, but cinema as such. I mean, at best, there would be references to Hexen as a kind of wacky early film that maybe, you know, maybe you could get a kick out of, or maybe not, but it was never really taken seriously as a cinematic object or as a landmark in the history of cinema. And so some of our motivation was fairly straightforward in that we felt that this was an omission in our understanding of the history of cinema. And we saw a place to sort of join into that conversation and provide something about a film that really should be known and talked about much more, and increasingly is. Ironically, nearly 100 years after its release, people are finally actually starting to watch this film again. And so those are some of the reasons. I don't know, I'm sure I forgot something. Todd, what are you?
No, I think that's right. And there's something else here. One of the issues with the with even talking about the film in the terms of in terms of innovation, it's so difficult. If you take, for instance, a film 1896, Demolition of a Wall, and you say, well, Christensen's using those same techniques, you know, in certain scenes in his film, so he's not really innovating. But it's not that he's developing unique techniques or special effects. That's really not where the value of his intervention lies. It's that he weaves these things together so masterfully over the course of this very, very long film. And we never get, in fact, actually, we never get the gimmickiness of, if that's a word, gimmickiness, the gimmickiness of these particular special effects. They're always in service of this narrative. They're always driving his thesis. And we have little things, like very special things, which are so uncharacteristic of a director who's coming from a theatrical and operatic tradition, where he's using things like these extreme close-ups, and we talk about this in detail in the film, in the book. He's using these techniques that, in fact, actually kind of, they betray the idea that it's just, you know, a theatrical production. And he's focusing on these individual characters, developing, you know, what seems to be a kind of thesis on their inner thoughts and you know, motivations and their sufferings. And we see him using these techniques in such a powerful way that I mean, I've watched the film now too many bloody times, but, you know, I tend to forget that this is something incredibly special in the moment in 1922. And so I think it's that ability to use these varied techniques, which of course are not of his own design necessarily, but to use them in a way that is so seemingly effortless. Of course, we do see the seams kind of come apart at certain moments in the film, but it's always, nothing is superfluous. It's always, you know, part of the thesis. You know, he's not just using techniques to use techniques. That, I think, is part of the innovation and the real, like, the demonstration of mastery on his part as a filmmaker. Of course, he's trying to master other things as well, which of course we talk about in the book, but I'll leave it there and tag back to Richard.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I'll just add one thing about that, because it would seem that the use of these techniques and special effects would rule out Hexen as a legitimate nonfiction film. And for many people that, you know, that immediately kind of comes to mind, like, how is this really possible? But yeah. But because he's trying to give us some sense of what it means to be confronted by the witch, or to be confronted as a witch, and, you know, an empirical element of what the being of the witch was in the 16th or 17th century, for example, was that you would see and feel things that were impossible, right? The impossibility of this, which we get in the accounts, in the contemporary accounts, in witch trials and confessions and so on, you know, this becomes a kind of solid, hard evidence for the presence of a witch or the operations of witches. And Christensen actually, while he is trying to thrill his audience, this is actually empirically sound as a technique. And this is one element of the film that I think makes it innovative as a nonfiction film or as a proto-documentary film, which is that the special effect is actually part of the evidence. And yeah. That's, you know, that's not something that people had necessarily noticed or taken seriously before. So just as an example, right, you know, it really takes a lot of thought and a great mastery of your craft to actually see that through in a way that's credible.
Yeah.
Well, I would, to date it, okay, the film came, he started working on the film in the late 19-teens, I guess that's the way we put it. Birth of a Nation came out in 1915, which is usually considered to be one of the first modern style films, so we use that as a guideline for, in case there's a question as to where this fits into that. But it's interesting, from your discussions, from just what you've talked about, it's hard to use this word for a film that's so big as this film is, but the subtleties are there. There's a lot of subtlety that obviously any good film you want to watch multiple times to pick up things, and this definitely is an example of a film that has quite a bit of subtlety to it, and it's some of it's the technical part, and some of it's just the way he presents his information. Of course, there's also the even today documentaries that have reenactments in them are still considered to be controversial. So, and of course, in his case, he couldn't find original footage of any sort. So, of course, he had to if he was going to do it, he had to reenact. So,
absolutely.
I mean,
the Errol Morris of witchcraft.
Right. So. Reenactments are considered to be a normal aspect of documentary, even now with documentaries. It's just a matter of how they're used. And obviously, any documentary that's not just meant there as a travelogue or as a you know an educational film is meant to tell a story or make a point. And you have to use the evidence that you have in order to make that point.
So can I just add just sort of one point of clarification, though? So he gets the money from the Swedes in 1919. Mm-hmm. And he disappeared. I mean, the Danish filmmaker gets the money from the Swedes in 1919 and then disappears for a while. And the film comes out in 1922. But there's the timeline gets a little bit fuzzy between the time that the Swedish Film Institute gives him money to buy back his studio in Copenhagen from creditors, paying off past debts. Going to Paris to do some research on Charcot's, you know, Salpêtrière and really kind of basically walking alongside these psychiatrists and others who were his acolytes. I mean, it's the labor of this film is not just the set designs and not just the production. I mean, so much of the energy and I imagine finances went into his research. And this is what we found so extraordinary as well. We knew that the film was well-researched, that it took so long to make. We didn't quite, I don't think, I mean, I can't speak for Richard, but I don't think I fully appreciated the intensity of that research in the beginning and how long it took and how bold it is to take people's money and to disappear for a little while and do research for not just this film, but for two others that were never made, but were meant to follow. So the timeline of his film and how he uses his resources is, and we talk about this in the introduction to the book, I think it's an important part of the story because it also gives you a little, even though we're not just writing a biography of Christensen, it does give you a sense of the seriousness of the task he's undertaking and also the risk.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is quite true. And Christensen actually does, you know, I mean, he does engages in very, very concerted and disciplined scientific labor, we could call it. I mean, you know, if we're linking things like historical studies to something that's that has an aspiration to touch on objectivity or science or that sort of thing. But he expands well beyond that to have some basic understanding of neurology, of developing Freudian psychoanalysis, and a whole host of domains of knowledge, you could say, that's required to make this film. And so, yeah, the intensity of his study, he basically disappears, not really to do fieldwork exactly like a traditional anthropologist would, but he definitely studies up. And I think that, you know, like Todd, I didn't really fully grasp this until we tried to follow the threads that he provides for us in the film, just to sort of get a handle on, you know, particularly in the first chapter of the film where he more or less lays out all of his sources and notes. It's kind of like it's like a manuscript in reverse in that the notes come before the narrative, so to speak.
Yeah.
And just tracing through all of that source material to try to, in some coherent way, just to know, just to keep it straight as these images and examples come by on the screen, just what's going on there. And that actually took quite a lot of effort on our part because, you know, we're not ourselves trained as, you know, early modern historians or anything of the sort. And so there was a lot of studying up for us as well that we needed to do. And I think that's a testament to just how, you know, how good he was at what he was doing, even though he wasn't necessarily recognized or trained or had a qualification in any of these disciplines. This was still a time in 1922 that, you know, I'll use this word advisedly, but that amateur intellectuals could still engage in this kind of work and be taken seriously. I'm not so sure there's room for that nowadays. Perhaps there is in some disciplines and not others, but I think that he takes advantage a little bit of his time in coming to this in a way that he's not in our terms today qualified to do, and yet he masters so beautifully and so obviously, even for experts trained in the field.
Well, and of course, he also made sure that not only is it obviously meant to be a film to be shown, but he also presented as part of the film, and you actually included in the book, all of his sources. So that he went down and documented exactly what he used in order to pull the material together. So he clearly documented, he cited his sources, to use a phrase, very carefully to make sure that everybody understood where how he was creating it. It wasn't one of those things where he was saying things without trying to back them up.
Yes, that's precisely right. And I think, that's quite deliberate and related to his claim that, this is in fact a nonfiction film. I am making a statement about the world that can be assessed as truth, or at least in relation to something real in the world, which is quite an extraordinary claim to make when you first come across the film, or when you just read a description of the film, a film about the witch craze, about witches. It seems contradictory. And he's very disciplined in expressing how, in fact, this is not so. It is not contradictory.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember the last time I went to a film and was handed a bibliography for the film before we started watching. I mean, there's something about that act. Could you imagine showing up and getting a program and you look inside and it's, here.
Look, I mean, he is a bit of an obsessive. I mean, only an obsessive could make this film. I mean, whenever I, speak in public about the book, and I always start with, a kind of stock phrase, which is, Benjamin Christensen's Hexen is a film born of an obsession. And then I go on to say, the book Realizing the Witch is also born of an obsession, and it seems like it's the same obsession. And, that's kind of the way I feel about it. I don't know.
We sort of do this.
Any true work of art, I mean, we can talk about, just in the film industry, how many films were works of obsession as well as love, labors of love. And I mean, you can point at very ones, and we want to even use somebody who I'm looking at some of your descriptions of Christensen, and the first name that came to my mind was Orson Welles. The concept of an obsessive mind that also has details and wants to break new ground and things like that. The theatricality of it all. Well, let's define a little bit, mostly because we've been, we've spent the first part of this just talking background, and I think it's clear that, especially for people who haven't seen the film, which are going to be most people probably at first who's listening to this. The film itself is broken down into seven parts. The word Hexen, based on the descriptions that I saw, means the witch, or witch. So obviously the film is meant to describe or present witchcraft as a topic. And as you pointed out, it was developed as nonfiction, what we probably would call documentary today. And as I say, it's seven parts, but this first part, and you mentioned it briefly a second ago, the first part is an introductory section that's pure exposition with a lot of diagrams and things. It literally is almost a classroom lecture in which he presents most, and then most of the rest of the film is dramatic formats, so little vignettes, and then also, but there's a clear line that goes through the entire film, which of course is presented in the last part, which he then comes into modern times and presents what he compares his main point, which was that witchcraft as a concept was an example of how people were being, who had unusual traits or issues or mental problems or other kinds of problems, were treated as far as what he calls hysteria.
Right.
So, I think I hit the basics of everything.
That sounds
like the film.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I just wanted to make sure I had that all out, since we've been talking a lot of background, so I wanted to make sure we talked about that. But let's go back then to the beginning. That first part, which each part, if I read correctly, each part basically equals one reel of film. Is that basically correct, the way I understood it?
Yes, I think that's more or less the case. You know, they would need to change the reels, and they wouldn't want to be doing that in the middle of the chapter. So I think it roughly times out that way. Yeah. Okay.
So part one, then, like I said before, is where he explains everything from the beginning. And what is he? Because, like I said before, he comes through and uses that. So what is he showing in that first part?
Richard, you want
to? Okay. What is he showing? I mean, well, I think in the broadest sense, what he's showing us are his sources. And so everything that comes later in a dramatic form is grounded in the evidence that we have, that he had in 1922 to make that reenactment and to make that claim. And the evidence consists primarily of 16th century visual culture that depicted the operations of the witch, the Satan's presence in the world, witch trials and tests that might be administered to determine whether or not a person had been bewitched or was engaged in witchcraft. We have an exposition of the tools, which occurs in the beginning, but then, you know, throughout the film, that's referred back to. So there's some technical elements in there. And I think he's trying to do two things in this section, which is number one, to ground the legitimacy of what comes later, in a sense. Since in a film we can't be flipping back and forth between what we're reading in the main text and where the footnotes are, he's going to have to kind of like give us all of that up front. Otherwise, the audience will not stay with what he's trying to do. Or they'll regard it in a way that I think he would have felt as incorrect, which is that this is a kind of a fantasy. So I think he's really trying to set up the film in a number of different ways by doing this. And this is a risky strategy because the first chapter is not the most scintillating chapter in the film. It's actually quite baffling to begin this way, considering how most documentary films, or just most films in general, begin. So when I show this film to my students, for example, I teach a film and anthropology course where I show this film as part of the course, and they're just kind of stunned even after the first chapter, because they really don't know why he's doing this, and it only becomes obvious later as to what he's doing. There is a little bit of evidence as to the intensity of what the experience of the witch was and is, I think. So some of the mechanisms and some of the more outlandish elements of the first chapter, I think it seems a little bit like a gimmick at times, you know, the sort of the mechanically operating version of hell that he displays, for example. That doesn't necessarily seem to perform quite the same function, but I think that it does, because I think it's that affective sense that he's also trying to weave in as part of the legitimate evidence for how people reacted to witchcraft or responded to it, and how it actually remains not so much as witchcraft unchanged from the 16th century, but how the power of the witch can detach itself from that figure and attach to other figures like the possessed or like the hysteric. So there's elements of that as well, but that only becomes obvious as we get into the later chapters, really.
I mean, that first chapter is such a wonderful preview, because actually he's showing, like, here is how 16th century Europeans and others imagined hell or Satan. Here's how it was that imagination was represented. And this, of course, is the same labor that he's going to engage in later in the film, you know, where he's going to, you know, help us imagine, and then, of course, later help us believe. But I think it's important also that those mechanical images, I mean, this is also a preview of what he's up to. He's going to animate these things. He's going to, you know, he's going to make these things living for you. And he begins by making these really meticulous, and, you know, they're completely drenched in smoke, and, you know, you see, you know, the fires of hell and brimstone, et cetera, et cetera. But it's the first moment in which he begins to animate things, and yet he's still in this mode of professor, because we see a pointer come into the scene and, you know, literally point to elements of the images that he's presenting. And it's so didactic and so humorous. When I I show this film as well. And every time people kind of giggle uncomfortably, like, what is this genre that we're witnessing? What is this thing? And so all that first chapter, despite the fact that it is so didactic, that it's just this kind of long inventory of representations of everything from early hysteria to, you know, scenes of hell, to the idea of the Egyptian notion of the underworld, which of course he recreates in his studio, which only comes on screen for 3 seconds, but I mean, he's filled his entire studio space to recreate this. It's a very disrupting chapter because you really don't know what you're getting into. And you don't, it's like, is this exactly what's going to come? Is it going to be more of the same? Is this a setup? And we have no idea at this point. So I find it in some ways like the first chapter, despite the fact that it is probably the most boring chapter, it is also the most disorienting. It's fascinating to rewatch it again and again.
Well, yeah, I'll just give a brief example of the how this, you know, the first chapter also works. It does kind of sort people out in the audience. I mean, we showed it with a live musical accompaniment here in Edinburgh in 2015 on Halloween. And so we're in a full house, a few hundred people have shown up to see the film, and the first chapter rolls, and you have the ones in the audience who have had a bit to drink before they come in, and they're really here for a midnight movie, have a good time, get a little drunk and rowdy, and by the end of the first chapter, they all walk out. And then you have the serious audience who sticks with it for the rest of the film. And it's a real, yeah, it kind of separates the wheat from the chaff here, you know?
So. Well, it sort of comes in as a college lecture at the beginning. You know, there's a huge amount of for a silent film, which, of course, it obviously is, the narration is huge in that first part. It's just, yeah. It's nothing but narration to a large extent, where obviously most silent films didn't have huge amounts of narration because that would require a huge amount of reading on the part of the audience. So you're sitting here watching that, and as you point out, you got the pointer and you've got the little parts that it illustrates in detail. First he shows the whole image and then goes to each individual part in close-up. And then with this long narration that you're reading along with, I could imagine you saying, am I just going to be sitting here reading an entire film for, you know, 2 hours?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, that's precisely it. And I mean, you know, it's done in such a way. It is, Todd is right. I mean, it is really quite disorienting because the first time you see it, you're not quite sure what he's up to. It almost seems like a burlesque of science at that point. I mean, it's so outlandishly concerned with the sort of the appearance of empirical veracity and science. You know, it's hard to get a handle on just what his position is in relation to the science that he is also seemingly referring to and depicting, because there is just a kind of burlesque quality almost. I don't think that's intended, you know, and I think that becomes clearer if you stick with the film and continue. Mm-hmm. But at first you just wonder, you know, is this surrealism before they were making films? You know, this is 10 years prior to Buñuel's Land Without Bread, and yet it seems very similar. But I actually think they have very different aims in some sense. So, yeah.
So before we start, I want to talk about the book now in more detail. But before we get to that, I wanted to briefly, I just want to discuss the concept of the word hysteria, which he used, you know, which we've pointed out is his overall point, that what was being called hysteria, what does he mean by hysteria as far as the modern time period in the 19, you know, at the period he was making the film, which of course was just after World War I and a number of other things going on. So what is he bringing into his beliefs of when he talks about hysteria?
Well, this is a curious topic, actually. I mean, hysteria at the time, of course, is a catch-all for any number of neuroses. And he's deriving his notion of hysteria very much from the Charcot's neurology clinics in Paris and the writings that, you know, influence, of course, Freud was one of Charcot's most famous students, and, you know, really the writings and the people who were influenced by Charcot, and how that notion of hysteria, especially in women, began to become popularized, leaving the 19th century, beginning the 20th century. By the time 1922 rolls around, we know that after the First World War, there are other versions of hysteria which become quite important, especially in traumatized soldiers. So the shell-shocked soldier is the hysteric, is the male who's hysteric who has survived the war. And yet Christensen, that's completely off limits, or at least outside of the purview of Christensen's film. He's really appealing to a very popularized and in some ways actually a little bit antiquated notion of hysteria in the film, antiquated for 1922. His images, especially towards the end of the film, of the physician examining the patient, those would be very familiar to the audience that he was showing this to. This is not some scientific revelation of a new diagnostic category. This is something that has very much entered the kind of popular culture and very much is part of a vocabulary by which people understand mental illness. And so I think that's an important point, because it's not so much that Christensen is necessarily, even as a trained physician who, you know, doesn't practice medicine, decides to become an opera singer, but, you know, as somebody who's very aware of the circulation of ideas in psychiatry and psychoanalysis, very early moments of psychoanalysis, he's aware of the reception already. And in some ways that clears a path for him to advance his thesis. So it's not so much that he's educating his audience about hysteria, it's that he, or any particular kind of neuroses, including senile dementia and all kinds of other things that kind of come in sort of on the periphery towards the end of the film. It's not that he's educating his viewers, it's that he's using ideas that they already are familiar with to then insert his thesis into that set of ideas. So hysteria is very important here. Now, we write at the very end of the book about how male hysteria is off limits, and it's a glaring omission. The war is only mentioned one time in the film at all, and it's the woman who's the kleptomaniac at the end of the film who's lost her husband to the war, and it's really just, it's just an aside. So, but that category of hysteria is so important, so central, but it's also so well known to the viewership.
Yeah, that's basically, yeah, I don't really have much to add on that. That's really what he's doing. And the kind of, Christensen does go back and forth between, you know, having a very up-to-date and a very acute grasp of all kinds of historical and scientific material. But he does, when he needs to, he'll use a more popular idiom that might actually reflect an antiquated diagnosis. I think Todd is even being a bit generous to say that it's on the edge of being antiquated, because I think within the science of nervous illness, hysteria was on the wane. Yeah. But this is the way to speak to the audience, and there is an aspiration to bring this material to a popular audience. So this wasn't, even though it starts out looking like a classroom film, it actually, this was supposed to be a popular film, and it, given its expense, it was supposed to make money and be seen by a lot of people. Now, things turned out differently, but I think that, you know, Christensen is making some difficult decisions as to, you know, just what idiom will get this to an audience, and then to come back to his thesis about, you know, the witch and the power of the witch, and try to get those sitting in the audience to actually take this quite seriously and to take their own position seriously in relation to, if not the witch as it existed in the 16th century, to other quite unsettling and unexplained forces or persons or beings that might be present to them. And I think that's really important to remember, given that we are coming out of the war. He makes no direct reference to the war, but I don't think a film like Hexen makes sense had the war not happened, if that's clear. Mm-hmm. People were asking a lot of quite profound existential almost questions about the nature of human life and human civilization that opens the door for a film like Hexen to actually pose the big questions that I think it ultimately aspires to pose and does pose, in my view, in our view, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, Richard, I totally agree with your point.
You totally agree. Well, thank you, Todd. Thank you.
I mean, it's the aftermath of the war. It's the rise of psychical research. You know, the idea of spirit, you know, all of this, all these sort of popular developments of spiritualism, which of contacting the dead, the family members who were lost. I mean, there's this very fertile ground for Christensen's film. But I want to say just one last thing about his relationship to psychiatry. I mean, this is where Christensen as a figure so dominates his film. He doesn't recede to the background. The film, of course, stands on its own, but he's so bound up with this film. I mean, he's not just using Charcot's photographs or the writings of Charcot's students, and in particular, Bonneville, who edited this long series, this Bibliothèque Diabolique, which had all of these meditations on early modern images of witchcraft and their relationship to contemporary hysteria. I mean, he was a student of Charcot in his own way. He knew all of these guys in Paris. And so his animation, his taking up the category of hysteria is in some way it's also so precise and so masterful because he really does know that domain inside and out. And I think that's why in some ways the film is so powerful, because he's not just talking from the periphery. He's really at the center of a lot of these conversations. Now, I don't know what his relationship to psychical research was necessarily. I mean, he read all of those people, especially the Americans. So he was, I think, very aware of that literature that was, you know, contemporary to his time. I mean, it was things that were being published, you know, just in the moments before he begins filmmaking. But he has an acute awareness of that literature. But I don't know how bound up he was or how well he knew the people who were producing that literature and who were part of those societies. But he certainly had very, very deep roots in especially Parisian psychiatry, which is curious.
As somebody who teaches history, when I know I've always said to students, you always have to consider the history. When you're considering history of an event or a time period, you have to look at how it was being considered at the time. You can't make judgments based on current events to make a judgment for the past. And we know the period after the First World War was an incredibly scary time for a lot of people between the economy, but then the psychological aspect. And there's a lot of material that came out of the post-World War I period, and both artistically and in other ways, that just shows how the war affected people. And given that both in Europe and the United States, everywhere, because it was just so massive and what it did to people. And even though you're right, he barely mentions World War I, the more you know about that period, the more what he did makes so much sense.
Well, that also, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, when you realize that the film was censored or banned in different places, you kind of have to question, like, what were people's sensitivities in Europe? I mean, you know, you have not just the war, but then you have the influenza outbreak. You have just death abounds. And yet his film is being banned for we can talk about this specifically.
Yes, I don't know. It depends on the country, but quite often in Europe, it was banned or heavily censored for what was phrased as outrages against religion, which I thought
outrages against religion.
Exactly. A really interesting phrase. You know, in the United States, it tended to be not shown at all because of the nudity and the implied sexual dimensions to forming a pact with Satan, which was essential to his evidence as well, right? That this is what made it sensual and real. So the Americans were worried about sex, and the Europeans were worried about affronts to religion. Go figure, right? But there you go.
But let's talk about all the reactions to the film, it's because that's where we've been sort of walking around in this last couple minutes. Obviously, the word success does not necessarily go along with this film. It was not a success when it was released, right?
Well, not a financial success. That's no. Sure. No.
Yeah.
So, but did he? Were there people who saw the film and actually gave him credit for what he was doing, for what he did?
Well, I mean, yes. You know, the film was seen. Certainly, it was seen relatively unchanged and unmolested in Scandinavian countries, and there were, you know, there were reviews, and I think that actually the box office there wasn't terrible. But when it starts to go outside, that's when, you know, it starts to run into certain kinds of problems. And so, you know, there are reviews and a little bit of some critical commentary, which we do make reference to a bit in the book. And of course, it was seen by industry professionals. So Louis B. Mayer sees the film and says, "This man's either a genius or he's crazy." And
can
Mayer
he be
bet.
Both?
Well, you know, Mayer bet on one or the other. I'm not sure, but he did get a contract to go to Hollywood, and so it did provide him the opportunity to come to the United States to make films, which did not turn out very well. He wasn't, you know, Benjamin Christensen was not particularly well suited to a studio system as it existed in America, and so that wasn't necessarily a success, but it did open opportunities for him. So the film, you know, it's not like it was completely suppressed or completely unknown, but it did kind of come and go without really, I would say, based on the evidence that we could look at, it wasn't really received in the manner that Christensen wanted it to be received, not only in terms of a popular audience, but even in terms of an understanding or an interpretation of witchcraft or the subjects at hand. It is re-released in Scandinavia, in Denmark, at least in 1941. And Christensen provides a fascinating kind of spoken introduction to the film where he talks about his aspirations and so on. Doesn't really refer to it as a failure, but you can see that he's still, even 20 plus years or nearly 20 years later, still trying to get that point across. But no, I wouldn't say I don't know. But as Walter Benjamin said, I mean, nothing is ever lost to history. And so I think the success or failure of the film on these terms is still to be seen in a weird sort of way. That's part of the reason why we did write the book. Not as a, you know, a sort of noble act of recovery, but just, you know, to step into a place to say some things that had yet to be said. And actually, the film invites that kind of engagement. So it's life as a work in the public domain is really very strange. And we also have the very strange diversion, I would say, in the 1960s, where the film basically is recut, given a free jazz score and some intonations from William S. Burroughs. The intonations are great, the free jazz is not, and it becomes a kind of midnight movie where people go, and again, they try to have a good time, and I suspect don't have as good a time as they think they're going to have, you know, in midnight cinemas of the late 60s and early 70s. So success, that's a difficult one to kind of assess. I mean, financially, it was a disaster. But as a work available to us, I think this is actually still an open question, which is what's exciting about engaging with it.
I think part of the fact that we're still talking about it does, as you point out, make it successful. It's still something worth considering, and it's still being viewed, which is a great thing. We haven't really been talking about the book per se, but we've been talking around everything related in the book. So I don't want it to seem like we're not talking about the book. Because clearly, everything you've talked about, the two of you have talked about so far, have been related to what you wrote about. I mean,
well, sure, it's what you say in the book, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The nice thing is, and that's why I think any good book, as far as I'm concerned, the introduction is so important, because it lays out, you know, like Christensen, we consider your introduction to be the first section. You're explaining everything, what you're going to be talking about, and then you go on to do it. That introduction, which gives the background of the film and his background, which is so great. And then you get into some of the things like the evidence he portrays, you know, what he used for his evidence, and really lays out very nicely all the evidence and the material that he reviewed in order to create the film. And you've got some interesting images that are also used in the film, which I think does a great job of continuing to show what your points were concerning what he did with the film. As far as how long did the book take for you to write? Obviously, as you pointed out, this is something that you've been dealing with for a long period of time. So as a topic, this film, but how long have you really worked on this project?
Ooh, four weeks. Depends. Yeah. What were you afraid on? I mean, because we saw the film years ago and kind of instantly were drawn in. It's not like we saw it and knew that day that we would be writing a book about it, but it would just never sort of leave us alone. And we came around to do the work. Todd, I don't know. What would you say? Did it take us a year or?
Well, I mean, I think I would probably say that it took us 3 or 4 years to do. I mean, I was living in Detroit when we were doing most of the writing for the book, and Richard was already in Edinburgh. And we had been sketching things out, collecting materials, you know, watching the film obsessively, talking over Skype and over telephone, consulting with the third member of our posse, Stefanos Gerlanos at NYU, who we do a lot of writing with in different capacities and a lot of thinking with. But we had been really building up our own archive and also, you know, trying to, it wasn't that difficult to understand Christensen's project because we were doing something similar. We were really making an effort to collect all the materials that he cites, including material that would support that material. So doing that one extra step, trying to build our own sort of bibliography or inventory of research for each of these chapters. I would say that process took a couple years. Mm. And then Richard and I were able to spend a week together at this, how would you describe it, Richard? Like an artist?
I don't know. We had a residency at an arts retreat, I guess you could say. I mean, it's a, in rural Scotland, a place called Cove Park, which supported us in going and basically living on site, engaging with some of the other artists there, which is kind of the idea. You know, they're artists in residence who then communicate with one another and kind of, create ideas together, I guess. Working on their own stuff, but being stimulated by other creative people around them. And they don't normally do this for academic writers, but we were able to, in this case, go up there and just, yeah, I don't, other than a few walks around, I mean, we really just sort of stayed in the flat they gave us and just wrote together for 18 hours a day kind of thing.
So Christensen's film is divided into these 7 chapters. The book is divided into these 7 chapters. We had 7 full days to work on bringing together all of our source material. The first day when we got there, this doesn't count as part of the 7 days, we drove a truck into town. I think we banged it up pretty good, getting back and forth to town on winding Scottish roads. Then we had all of our food in the house, a couple bottles of wine. And then we had this task of churning out a draft of each chapter a day. And it was a 10-hour day, 12-hour day, and there was no internet. And so we just sat and we just wrote, and there's nothing more hellish than actually having that much uninterrupted time every day. It's beautiful and a horrible burden at the same time. But we churned out 7 chapters in a week, obviously having done all of the research and compiling things ahead of time. But it was our one opportunity to sit down and be in the same room together. And to write together. And I think that was a really major part of the book coming together. It is the kind of book that is a sustained conversation between the two of us about the film and about the material. And I think without the opportunity to actually have that real conversation in a sustained way, I don't think the book would have taken the form it did. Now, of course, then we spent the next year and a half editing, revising, taking in other people's edits, et cetera, et cetera. It was a long process, but those 7 days were really, you know, I think Richard and I have a new book project that we're, you know, working on this, finishing this summer. And I mean, I think it's going to be the same thing. We're scheming already to be in the same room for an extended period of time. just to have that luxury of time together to write, which it seems like such a banal thing to say, but in fact, actually,
I think it was important, you know, not only to bring the project together, but also, I mean, it is, you know, I'm often asked about this by colleagues or someone who's run across the book, and they say, gosh, you know, how is it that you and Todd were able to do this? Because it seems like a single voice. And the reason it seems like a single voice is because we do come together like this and craft, I think, not only the project and the argument and everything that a book needs to be, but also a voice for the book, which is not precisely the same as my individual authorial voice. And it's not precisely the same as Todd's, you know, writing voice, but it is related to both, and it's ours. And I think that, you know, we have an intense period of time where we fashion our voice. And that's what was kind of crucial to the whole thing. So I don't know. It's kind of actually being asked that question, I have to think really hard about the sort of timelines of things, because on the one hand, parts of it came together so intensely and so quickly, and other parts of it were really, like Christensen's own process, very long periods of working with the materials or just thinking and obsessing and stewing about the film. So I could say that, you know, it took us a week or it took us a year or we worked on this for 10 years, and all of these answers could be defended as correct. But yes.
Sounds like, you know, true obsession.
Exactly.
You don't remember what it was like when you weren't living with it.
Well, exactly. That's right.
It's interesting. I asked the question earlier about success. The funny part about, we said, yes, we can call it successful on an artistic level and a lot of other levels. Fact of the matter is it's successful because it's a film from that period that is still in existence. As we know, a lot of films from that period of time have long since disappeared. The fact that it still exists is a great thing. And in fact, that it's available for purchase on, you know, Criterion has an edition that not only has the film, but it's also got the 1941 introduction is included on there, as is the 1968 jazz version is available on the same DVD. Somebody who wants to really study it the way you folks did, instead of reading your book, in addition to reading your book, they can do the studying themselves. It's all included on the DVD. It's available for purchase on iTunes. It's available for streaming. And so really it was successful because we can still study it ourselves and look at it and see what he did.
I think that's certainly the case. And I think its argument itself is also successful in some ways on its own terms, because it does allow us to think about certain elements of the present in critical ways that we wouldn't have thought of or thought about if we hadn't actually seen the film. And that might pertain to phenomenon like witchcraft, which does still exist in most parts of the world today, but also just, you know, about what the power of the witch was in the first place, which, say, I don't know, in Europe or in America, we wouldn't necessarily attach to the figure of the witch anymore, but there are those out beyond the pale, out of bounds, highly dangerous and mysterious beings that seem to come into our lives, threaten us, shape our lives, that kind of thing. So I actually do think that it does have a success in that way as well. Maybe people don't always see it at first, but that's another reason why we wrote the book, because it's hard to get a grasp, even having seen the film once or twice, just what's going on in it. And hopefully this does lead people, you know, the book does lead people to the film. And hopefully they do, you know, have the book handy as they watch the film. That's a little scary, because they can look at every single interpretation we make and say, oh, I agree with that, or I don't agree with that. I mean, you know, it's a pretty exposed sort of a way to work in some ways, but that's fine. I think that we both just sort of envisioned it that way, you know.
Well, nowadays there is hysteria in a variety of ways. And so, frankly, the concepts of, even though we don't usually blame them on witchcraft anymore, there is still the same concept that we can often find realism, real reality, excuse me, boy, I can't get that word out, reality, to prove where the hysteria is actually coming from. But that's where I, once again, believe that this film was, we'll use the phrase, ahead of its time, in that sense of being able to lay out a thesis in a logical way, but in an artistic way as well.
Well, sure. And I don't know. I'm sorry, Todd, I'm doing all the talking here at this point, but I'll get this point out. I actually, both of us, we really hope that our colleagues in anthropology and others in the social sciences, or the sort of human sciences, as they used to be called, also kind of have a look at this, because it is also an account of disciplines like ours in its own way. We do try to draw the film into conversation with the disciplines that it draws upon to formulate its original thesis, and then extend that a little bit further. I mean, there are certain parallels in not only how Christensen went about his work and how someone like me or like Todd would go about their work. You know, maybe the fieldwork part of that is not quite right, but in more general terms, I think that there is a parallel to be drawn. But also just looking at how witch hunters and, you know, inquisitors of the 16th century could actually formulate tests and credible evidence out of something like testimony, for example, which was something quite new at the time. You didn't necessarily prove or disprove the truth of something through what just a regular person was saying about it. This this is introduced in this period and in this context. And so looking at a text like the Malleus Maleficarum, and then looking at something like Malinowski's Argonauts of the Western Pacific, and seeing certain uncomfortable parallels between the two, I think is a story that we also want to tell. So we're telling a story not only about the witch and about hysteria, but also about how it is that an anthropologist or a social scientist or somebody in the humanities, or even a natural scientist, if we want to extend this, how we make truth, how we make an argument, how we apprehend and grasp the world and say something or express something about it. And I think that that's a very complicated story that Christensen doesn't solve, but actually gives us a very interesting example of how it happened, and how in the context of how his own work exists, how he went about that. So I wouldn't say it's a disciplinary history, but there is a history of certain kinds of concepts and practices that that I would argue, and I think we both argue in the book, are extremely relevant for anthropologists or others who do work like this. Just knowing the history of knowledge, and the history of how we go about our business of saying something truthful or meaningful about the world. And I think that's very strong in the film, and we really try to bring that out in the book as well.
I'll just add one thing. The working title for the book was Evidence of Forces Unseen, and it was that framing of the film and of our own sort of engagement with the literatures and disciplines that surround the film. I think that really was the framework that we were operating within, which is, you know, what is it about evidence? What is it about securing evidence in this film that's so important? And how does that extend into even more contemporary conversations?
Well, I think we could probably talk for a lot longer. We've already gone well over an hour, which is great. I mean, I'm hoping I know sometimes length is not always that's quantity over quality, but I think we got quality. So I think it's a good point to sort of leave it. I still have other questions I could ask, but I think it's a good point to stop, only because I think we've done a great job of not only showing what you presented in the book, but also hopefully bringing the film to a whole new audience of people who may have heard of it, never watched it, or maybe just first heard of it by this interview. And hopefully it will continue to be the relevant film, both of the period and of the genre and of the artistic material that it is.
Well, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to talk about it. I mean, you know, it's always great to not only talk about something we did together, but to continue to engage with the film. So thanks very much, Joel. I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate both of your time. So thanks a lot. And I'm glad we were able to get this to talk about this.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation. In addition to reading the book, I hope that you watch the film Hexen. I think you'll find the combination of the two to be very enlightening. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film.